Hello, Will.
Hey, Rohan.
How's it going?
Yeah, very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. How's the last week been?
Not too bad. Pretty eventful. Moving out of, well, for the nation, right? Prince Philip died. That's pretty big news. And also we're out of lockdown.
Are you an ardent royalist?
So I'm not anti-royal.
Okay.
I'd say I probably lean sort of slightly pro-royal, just in terms of I think they're quite a useful commodity for the UK to have. And I think in terms of national spirit, they're quite they're often quite unifying. But I'm not like, you know, waving my flag out the window every day, that kind of thing.
Tell anyone who does that. It'd be good to meet them. We should have them on this podcast.
Yeah, invite them. Anyone who's really keen on waving flags out windows, we will speak with
preferably
you.
The Union Jack rather than like the French flag or something.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting when people prefer to have the St. George's Cross over the Union Jack. That's a very pro-England kind of person.
It is. You know, the other thing I've also in my conquest of flags of the world learned is that there is a flag with four tiny St. George's flags in each of its corners, okay, along with a big red cross in the middle.
Sound like Malta or something.
Close. It's ironically Georgia.
Okay.
Which makes sense, I suppose.
Okay, yeah.
So I don't actually know if St. George's went to Georgia, but or if George's really took his name.
I mean, so I think he was like, I don't think he was, I think he was the saint in many places. I think there are quite a few places that have him as their patron saint. I don't think he's just like England. So, you know, I guess they saw the England one and thought, we can do better here. Just to one up it. But. Yeah.
Well, the other interesting thing I found out recently is it's actually a very convenient thing for the world that the Queen didn't pass.
Okay.
Because if that happens, well, when that happens, not only it obviously creates a lot of work for people in the UK from an administrative and bureaucratic point of view, but it also has huge economic repercussions, which I was completely unaware of.
Is this because of the Commonwealth?
It is because of the Commonwealth. So essentially what has to happen is trillions of coins have to be completely changed over, which is no small feat, as I'm sure you can imagine. So it's actually a really expensive affair, the death of a monarch.
But they are, so they're always discussing like getting rid of coins or getting rid of the 1p coin, the 2p coin. I guess then would be the time to do it, right? If you're gonna, because if you're gonna be doing it anyway, you may as well be like, true, you know, no one needs 5p
there's a contingency
anymore.
Plan. I mean, I'm sure there is, or at least I hope there is. But obviously like countries like Canada and Australia would have to redo their entire currency, which must be a very expensive endeavor.
Yeah, and difficult. I mean, so when we changed the £5 note, I think they did a, like, I don't see £5 notes anymore. They did a pretty good job there. But obviously,
you mean
they,
the old £5 notes?
Yeah, so when they changed to the new, like, more plasticky thing. Yeah. But obviously, they did £5, then a couple months later, £10, then a couple months later, £20. Having to do everything at the same time is probably pretty tricky. But maybe they'd do it in phases as well.
Yeah, I don't actually know. I mean, I was thinking about this because I don't think many people will have been alive at the time of a coronation of a new monarch. So I think we're quite lucky. Well, I don't know if lucky is the right word, but we've timed it, so we'd probably be able to witness that.
So I guess unless the monarchs lived significantly longer than normal people, you would hope that you'd get at least one coronation in your life.
I wonder if there is a correlation between how long monarchs live versus their people.
So,
I guess they're generally more sheltered, and I mean, this is based on my limited understanding of the royal family.
I think also, you know, sort of globally, a lot of life expectancy is due to, like, or why it might be low is due to infant mortality. And definitely historically, everyone was like, oh, people only live to 20. But actually, if you got past 20, you'd actually live, you know, pretty long. But it's just lots of people died before.
I always thought that was misleading when they gave life expectancy in average. I think I always thought it should be better as a median.
Median,
Or maybe even, probably not a median.
Range?
Yeah, or suppose a standard deviation, but I suppose that's quite a lot for someone to understand. In terms of, I don't know how many people know the intricacies of a Poisson distribution. So.
I guess it's worth trying and then seeing what happens. But yeah, I mean, I guess you could anticipate that they might live longer because they have, I suppose, easier lives. But equally, they're often very busy. Like, but equally, I think being busy helps us, you know, sustain you. You see lots of people, or at least I'm aware that there's an effect of people sort of slowing down after retirement, not because they've just magically, this is when I slow down, but because they don't have stuff to do.
I wonder if it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy as well. It's like, I've retired, therefore I have nothing to do.
Yeah.
I have nothing to do, therefore I don't have any. And then kind of the cognition.
Exactly. And Prince Philip retired from royal duties when he was, I think, I was reading in the paper the other day, I think 96 or 94.
Wow.
That's pretty impressive.
So I actually have a story about Prince Philip, which is, I was actually a medical student at the world infamous Hospital of Papworth, which I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's this really strange hospital that's built essentially about 15-20 miles outside Cambridge, maybe not even that.
Okay.
And it's world leading cardiothoracic center. So it's where I went to train for cardiothoracic surgery. We got to see some really cool operations there. And that's where Prince Philip goes to, or used to go to, get all his heart stuff done.
Okay.
And there was one week when actually he was admitted. I can't remember quite exactly what the procedure was, but they essentially had to empty out the entire ward. So he had the whole ward to himself. Yeah, so it's very...
That can't be helpful for the NHS.
No, but I suppose when it's essentially the king, you make special dispensations.
Okay. So, because I know he was in the hospital recently, is that where he went?
Yeah.
Okay.
But the Papworth's recently been moved to Cambridge, so they're kind of centralising all the hospitals slowly to Cambridge. So, but really fascinating hospital. It was kind of built on these porter cabins because they thought, we're going to move it to Cambridge one day, and then it took about 40, 50 years for them to do so. I think when I was in medical school, I thought they'd probably do it when I was there, and then they did it about a couple of years ago.
Okay.
So yeah, they take their sweet time, as with most things.
Always takes a while. So when I was at uni, my department building, they found out there was tons of asbestos in it. And you know how with asbestos, if you just leave it, it's fine. Well, they messed around so much with it. So we got an email one day saying, you can't go into the building anymore. It's very dangerous. Leave it. And so they set up porter cabins for the department. And they're all still there. Like, I don't think they've rebuilt the department building. It's going to take a long, long time.
Asbestos is a really interesting one as well, because there's two really, interesting from, I suppose, a morbid medical perspective. But the first thing is that it causes a very strange type of lung cancer. So it's not a standard lung cancer. So it's called a mesothelioma. And it behaves very differently to lung cancers. So it's essentially a cancer of the lining of the lung. It's called the pleura.
Okay.
So it's around the lung, but it behaves very differently. And the second more interesting and worrying thing is that with most carcinogens, there's generally a dose-dependent relationship between the dose and the risk of cancer developing. So, for example, if you work at Fukushima nuclear station and you're constantly being exposed to radiation, you're much more likely to develop a cancer. Or if you're in the middle of Chernobyl, then you're more likely to develop thyroid cancer, for example.
Okay.
But asbestos seems to be the only carcinogen that we know which is not dose dependent at all, in the sense that even a small amount of exposure can actually lead to cancer.
Same risk.
Yeah, which is, we're not quite sure of the mechanism, which obviously is quite scary when you think about it, because you may have been accidentally exposed to, you know, a few seconds of it.
Probably have. I was in that building lots.
Should we move on to the topic now?
I guess, yeah. Quite a long preamble to it. But we were supposed to be talking about libraries today.
Maybe some libraries have asbestos in them.
I imagine a lot will, yeah. Mm. Stay out of libraries, kids. That's my camp.
But not until you've listened to this.
Yeah.
So, on that bombshell that Will may have mesothelioma in 20... So you'd be happy to know it takes about 20 to 30 years for it to manifest.
I've got a while then.
So you're okay.
Okay. All right.
So, we're talking about libraries today, Will.
Mm.
Why have we chosen this?
So I think it's something which it is, like, it's quite a big thing when you're at university using libraries. I remember at school, didn't really spend much time in libraries. Local libraries are pretty much dying out now. If you're lucky, your school might have a library, but you don't probably spend much time there. Then when we moved to university, suddenly everyone's in the library.
Yeah,
you know, they'll you know, leave the library, go to dinner, then go back. So there's a huge shift in the usefulness in libraries. And I don't know if it's because there's now the need for it or if it's just a cultural thing. Mm. But I thought it was definitely worth talking about, like, you know, how we approached it and maybe what's good about library work, what isn't good.
I suppose there's two issues. It's the essentially the why there's a sudden shift from school to university.
Yeah.
And the second is the kind of pros and cons of a workplace setting.
Yes. So I think one thing is, you know, at school, you've got a classroom where you're working for 8 hours a day and you can do most of your work in that time. But at university, you might have lectures, but then you're expected to do a lot of work outside of that. So you need to generate yourself a classroom somehow. Mm. And I guess the library is that for most people.
So essentially you're replacing your classroom from school is your kind of hypothesis.
Yeah, well, so that sort of covers why there isn't a need for it when you're at school, but there is a need for it when you're at university.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting concept. Do you think that it could also be due to the intensity of work? Because I suppose from personal experience, I didn't really have to work that hard when I was at school, whereas at uni, we've talked about this, I had to work pretty much constantly, especially during exam term.
Mm.
Do you think there might be an element of that?
Yeah, I think so. And I think even more for people who have low contact time, like the more humanities people, where you are only having one lecture a day, but you need to do a day's worth of work to do what you need to do. Those are the kind of people that you do see in the library all day, and they sort of emerge at meal times and then
Yeah, it's interesting. And I suppose people stay in school 9 to 5 or, well, 9 to 4 or so.
Yeah.
Whereas in a uni, you're kind of in control of your own timetable. So you may think that actually just going to lectures is enough, but then may not want to work at home. So I suppose, and this is probably a good time to do this experiment, is how students have been reacting. So 17, 18-year-olds have been doing. Now that they can study at home, do they prefer to study or do they prefer to be in the classroom?
Yeah. I mean, so my brother is a 17-year-old and I know he prefers to be at home.
It's almost like I bought that on purpose.
But I think it's...
He prefers to be at home, sorry.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. But that's because he, like, generally, there's less to do. I think being homeschooling has also had with it less work overall.
Okay.
For a large number of people. And so I don't think it's not a good control, because you've got two things that are changing there. Because from his perspective...
It's almost like the schools didn't think of, you know, doing this properly, this experiment.
Yeah. So, from his perspective, any option where there's less work is better, because, you know, he's a teenager, he wants to do his own stuff. Certainly he prefers away from home. But a lot of the, you know, students who are looking to go to Oxford or Cambridge that might come across us, they're often saying, it's been really annoying. I'm looking forward to school being back open. So I guess that sort of, we can, you know, select our samples, and I suppose that sort of counteracts that variable a little bit.
Yeah. James, if you're listening, you should work hard.
Yeah. He'll be annoyed at me for saying that, but he'll know it's true.
Okay. I hope he doesn't listen to this.
No, you don't think he'll benefit from it?
No, you might just end up in a fist fight a few weeks.
That's true. We'll manage.
So I suppose what you're saying is that people essentially try and simulate their own classroom at one, they get to university, because they don't really have the option of having someone talk at them for the whole day, rather, because, well, humanity subjects in particular is less contact time.
Yeah. I think, you know, sometimes, and it varies from uni to uni, but sometimes you could have an hour a day of contact time, or significantly less. Certainly if you're in, like, dissertation season, you could have no contact time.
Yeah.
At which point you need to put yourself in a classroom environment.
Yeah.
Otherwise you're going to struggle.
And some universities do things like reading weeks. Are you familiar with this concept?
So I know of them. I never had a reading week.
No, me neither. They sounded great.
So from what I've seen of other people, it's basically just usually a holiday, and they'll use that to go abroad or something like that, and then
oh really okay
oh yeah yeah
oh wow
and then and Very then ca- catch up on the reading when
that
they're
was
back.
Meant to, yeah, not in yeah. reading week.
Because you can do reading whilst you're
abroad.
Well, yeah, you can. I suppose it depends if your reading helps you enjoy your holiday or not.
Yeah, I had one friend who actually went to California in the height of exam term, about 2 or 3 weeks before his exams.
Okay.
And his logic was, I'll work better in California. I mean, he was from Hong Kong. I think he just really wanted to go to Disneyland, to be honest.
Yeah.
And he sent us lots of photos.
Okay.
He didn't do as well as he probably would have had he stayed with it.
That's surprising.
Yeah. But he had a great third year, so.
Yeah, I'm sure he really enjoyed it. I think I would, whilst that seems good on paper, I don't think I'd be able to enjoy the holiday because of the looming threat of
I suppose it depends exams. On how much you care about your final result.
Yeah, and also how much, if you genuinely were so ready that there was nothing more you could do, then that's probably a good position.
Yeah, I suppose if you're plotting your exam readiness on a scale of 0 to 100%,
yeah.
When do you think is the ideal time to hit that 100%? Is it day one, minus one, before your exam, or minus 30?
I think it's probably a couple weeks before the real thing.
Okay.
I do think also it depends a bit on how focused your exam period is. If you've got 5 days, two exams each day, then you need to be ready a bit more in advance than if you've got one exam, then a few weeks, and then another exam, then a few weeks, then another exam. Because it's in the first scenario, you have no time in between to make any significant difference.
Yeah. I suppose also we'd probably want to add an extra line, because I'm saying 100% exam ready, but is that from a knowledge perspective or a psychological perspective? Because you can be psychologically ready, but actually not know as much as you probably should, and vice versa.
Yeah, that does happen.
I had one friend who just constantly thought she was going to fail, and she'd got first in her first and second year. She ended up getting a first in her third year, of course. But
Swine. But
she constantly thought she was going. She had this almost pathological fear of failure that at one point she was like almost didn't go to her exam because she thought she was going to fail it. To come out with the first at Cambridge as well, it's just
the audacity.
Yeah,
I guess for people like that, though, they'll never feel 100% ready. And you have to be very, very self-aware to be that kind of person and know that you're never going to be 100% self-ready and be okay with that. Because by nature of like their nature, they're not okay with that. But yeah.
If we bring it back to libraries
at
university, and I think of the top three performers from my college in medicine, they all did things very slightly differently. So one of them was essentially living in the library.
Yeah.
In fact, he had like a whole pile of stuff that had kind of accumulated over 3 months. He would...
Just a roll mat beside it.
Yeah, I mean, so our library used to close at 11, so we couldn't sleep overnight. But I'm sure
quite controversial. People didn't like that library shut. People were very pro 24-hour library.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, we should definitely talk about that. And one of them... didn't go to the library at all. She said if she went to the library, she would just, because there was Wi-Fi there, she would end up going on her phone and downloading all sorts of updates, whereas the lack of Wi-Fi at her room somehow preserved as a barrier. Will's looking at me really incredulously right now. But
it's bizarre,
It is bizarre. And the third one kind of did a hybrid. So I think she would go in when she felt that she wasn't being very productive at home to kind of shock her body or mind was her logic. So all very different approaches.
Yeah. And where did you...
And all of them got first, so...
So I guess any method can work. Yeah. I guess it's just the right method for you. But where did you fall within this spectrum?
Yeah, so I was firmly in my first year very much, I'll work at home. This is where everything is. I don't need to lug all my big folders and textbooks to the library. But what I found was actually I was a lot less disciplined in first year. So I used to sometimes study till 4 or 5 a.m. and then wake up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and then study. And it was just a really bad habit to get into. I was more disciplined in second and third year. And I felt more on top when I was going to the library. And it kind of forced me to study. But there were times when, obviously, when you make the trek in, the library is really good because it forces you to work and focus. And often, you know, we say... I haven't got the motivation. So I used to have this philosophy that motivation is just not really a thing. It's just something you create. It's an external factor that you can kind of bat away rather than something that's internally generated. But there were days when essentially I'd go to the library and I just really wasn't feeling it, and, you know.
Mm.
So there was one time I set my watch to beep every hour.
Okay.
And I would realize, so, you know, some days I'd go in at 10 o'clock and stay there till 10 in the height of exam term. And there were some days when the clock would beep and I realized I'd read about a paragraph.
Mm.
And I don't know if you had those, and I just figured, like, gosh, it'd be so much better if I was at home and I could recharge and then hit this really hard again.
Yeah. So I do think there is merit to the idea that if you are in that kind of situation, then it's difficult to just power through.
Mm.
And you might be better off having a half hour to do something else to sort of recharge or sort of just get your head in a different frame. My trouble is, like, getting the balance right.
Okay.
So I worked with pretty frequent breaks.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd sort of do 40 to 50 minutes and then 10, 15 minute break. So really frequent, you know, when sort of over 20% of your time is break. Yeah. That's a lot of time.
Pareto's principle.
Yeah, I suppose. But, you know, I needed that because otherwise, if I worked for like 2 or 3 hours, I just would be like, I'm done, I'm finished. And then that's less productive than having a more prolonged period with breaks.
Yeah. I think, you know, this kind of ties into the learning discussion we had last time, but it's much easier to learn regularly and often and small amounts and kind of try and cram everything in.
Yeah.
The trouble is, of course, some of these degrees, they have huge amounts of information, so you almost have no choice but to top it up at the end.
Yeah, and you need to have a lot of foresight to know this is going to take a long time, so I need to start early. Yeah. And you might be starting early whilst you're still doing essays from your normal duties as a student, and it's like, why am I revising when I've got this other stuff to be doing?
One of my friends had a big panic attack in the middle of exam term because actually he was really disciplined. He made meticulous notes throughout his first two terms. And when it got to exam term, it turned out that he'd spent so long preparing for exam term that actually he'd not remembered any of it. Yeah, so he'd never learned it. So then he kind of had like a panic attack, had to go home, and we all had to kind of calm him down. So it's very difficult. And of course, we got to see this kind of unfolding because we were in the library. So I suppose it's probably good to tell you a little bit about the structure. So we had a big hall in my library, but at the end of each hall were essentially big staircases, spiral staircases.
Okay.
And essentially there were two balconies that ran along the hall. So if you imagine like the Harry Potter, kind of the Great Hall in Harry Potter that you see on TV, it was essentially similar. And actually that's the rumour was that's where it was filmed. It was actually at a different college. I think it might have been at your college.
It's Christchurch, yeah.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons I applied to Keys, and I was very let down. So not only was it the wrong college, it was also the wrong uni.
Yeah.
But ignoring that, so essentially it looks like the Christchurch dining hall or the Hogwarts hall, but instead of just having four tables, you have obviously lots of bookshelves, but on top you have an extra layer. And I used to always sit in the balcony so I could see my friends revising. So it was a bit of, I found that quite like a solidarity kind of, like everyone's kind of going through not hell, but a rough time, but we're all in this together.
And so like everyone that I knew who went to the library regularly would have a spot.
Yes.
So it sounds like that was your spot.
I did, but so often, because I wasn't perhaps as diligent as some of my peers, I would arrive slightly later. And when in exam season, when the library gets really busy, people would just move your stuff out of the way. It was very inconsiderate.
Yeah.
And there was no system for reserving it.
So, yes. So I think generally there was sort of a bit of a honor code whereby if you're going to be gone for half an hour, it's fine to leave your stuff there, but if you're going to be gone for half a day, you should really take your stuff with you because it's a spot. And our library was not, whilst it was a very big building, there wasn't a huge amount of space in it given the number of students in the college. So, you know, it was important to be to let other people use it, basically. But of course, if you're there at 8 and you're leaving at 10, then keep your spot.
Absolutely. So I think I found the solidarity and being able to check in with my friends. And of course, if I got stuck, then I could go to them for help and vice versa. So it was quite sociable compared to the older alternative. Having said that, it wasn't too unsociable doing it at home in my room in first year. It was just you end up with these two cliques quite rapidly where everyone who works from home then starts to eat together and dine together and vice versa. My my library was very close to my college.
Okay.
So that helped because I could just nip away.
Was it
away.
Not in the college?
No, it was very. It was almost next to it.
Okay, but this is the college library, not the like department.
That's
library.
The college library. Yeah.
Okay.
So I could nip there for dinner, come back. That was quite nice as well.
Okay.
Sometimes I was a bit naughty and even had snacks in the at night.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, so definitely, I think being able to be around people whilst you're revising is important. And actually, one thing that I did in third year, which was probably the maybe one of the key determinants of my increased productivity, was actually just going to hall for meals all the way through the day. Because in first year, I basically only went to hall for dinner.
Right.
But I would wake up, go to breakfast, meet my friends who we all agree will go to breakfast because then you're up and you can be productive. And then you're away for a few hours from them. Then you pop back for lunch. And so you do have that opportunity to check in.
Yeah.
And I think that works quite well. And certainly some of them would then be like off to the library and I'd be off to my room.
Okay.
But you'd still get to see people. And there are certain people who sort of lock themselves away for that kind of thing. And I think if you are that kind of person, then you might want to go to a library because it forces you to not, basically.
Yeah.
Because... again, I think it's not a sustainable way to work, really.
I found it really hard to work after hall. There was no way I could work at home after going for dinner.
After dinner.
So the only way I could do it was going to the library. But then after 10, I had a rule of the 10 o'clock. Like unless I've got like an essay crisis, I would just come home. So that was my threshold. But
yeah,
sometimes I flew out the window when other people... So I'm also very competitive. And that kind of used to drive me on. So if someone's getting in for... 9 a.m. I would try and get in at 8:45. My friends were leaving at 10 o'clock. I'd leave at 10:15. And now, but with on reflection, I think, well, I'm not sure I learned that much.
Yeah.
It's more of a psychological feeling of productivity than an actual productivity.
If that's what helps, then, you know, placebos do cure people.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because when I was in second year, we used to have these exams, and which are multiple choice. And you may think, well, multiple choice are pretty easy. But they were negatively marked.
Okay.
And you could go in, and this was really well demonstrated, is essentially you could, three people could go in with exactly the same level of knowledge, and based on the psychology of when they sat the exam, they could do very, very differently.
Yeah, yeah.
So it doesn't always reward risk takers, but sometimes it can. So, but it tends to favour boys, is my understanding of it, because they tend to be slightly more risk seeking.
Okay.
Depends on the weighting of how...
Of how much you lose if you get it wrong. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think ours wasn't absurd. It was one plus one for a correct answer and minus half for
a negative. Well, I think because you can do it really statistically, because if you know that you've got a 50... Well, however many options there are, let's say there are five. If you know you've got a 20% chance of getting it right, then that's, you know, and then you can count that against the 80% chance of getting it wrong. And if the rewards counterbalance, then... it might be that you should always answer or you should never answer if you don't know. But that's certainly something that I'd want to know going into the exam rather than having to, you know, spending 10 minutes working it out. But yeah, I never really did multiple choice at school. And then all of a sudden, all the medics are doing it for their exams.
I mean, we barely had multiple choice in, well, I mean, biology, chemistry, maths and physics. I did those A-levels and never.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever had a... multiple choice then.
Yeah.
So it was real strange. And then of course they introduce essays at you, which is completely different to what you do at school. I mean, I think I wrote like three essays in sciences, and I was a bit of a nerd and wanted to.
Yeah. I found it quite funny all these scientists suddenly finding out that their subject is an essay subject as well. Because, you know, it's just not what you're expecting. But they did. And having done history, I was more than ready to do it all. But yes, so it sounds like you use libraries pretty extensively then.
Yeah, I think, so I suppose I tended to ramp up things quite significantly in Easter term, whereas things were generally relatively quiet in the first two. There was, for example, when I was writing my dissertation, probably on reflection, I probably should have just got a second monitor and plugged it into my home, but I instead went to the library every day and worked on my tiny laptop screen.
Okay.
And I probably would have been more productive at home.
Yeah.
The other thing I wonder is libraries can sometimes remove distractions.
Yeah.
I think that's why a lot of people like them. It's the feeling of if you go to work, it's the same as like if you're working.
Like an office,
It's a bit like an office for you. And they kind of say you shouldn't, for example, work in bed because colloquially your brain gets confused, for example. I think that was certainly true for me. So I kind of went a step further when I was in library mode. So I kind of put a geo tracker on my laptop, and then there was an app called Cold Turkey.
Okay.
So this is the height of the days of Facebook, for example.
Yeah.
When it was, if you're used to kind of compulsively checking, is actually you could easily spend an hour or two a day without even realizing it, which I found quite scary.
Yeah.
So I used an app called Rescue Time to track my time.
Okay.
And I was spending about 4 to 6 hours on Facebook a week, which I just was horrified by.
Mm.
So I used Cold Turkey to block access to all distracting things like the BBC, Guardian,
okay,
Independent Times, or everything, apart from work-related stuff, but only when I was at the library. So that was quite a nice workplace separation.
That makes sense, yeah.
So when I got home, I was kind of rewarded by... I won't say Facebook, that sounds really sad, but yeah, the ability to go on things like YouTube, for example.
Yeah, I know friends who had something similar, and I think it was to do with just looking at your phone generally.
Mm.
And whilst you weren't looking at your phone, the app would like grow trees.
Yeah.
And then eventually you have a nice big forest. And obviously it's a completely meaningless reward, but just the sense of something is enough to motivate you.
Yeah. I think I've got that app. I was terrible at it. My trees were all dead.
Trees were all dead.
Yeah, I was very...
Not enough of a motivator then.
Yeah. Well, I suppose I tend to think of motivation in terms of discipline more than motivation.
Okay.
So my theory on motivation is that the motivation has to come from within, because, for example, if we say, I want to run a marathon, we could say we're not motivated by it. But actually, most of us just need to say, I want to run 10 kilometers every day for the next 90 days, for example, and that will kind of automatically lead to a marathon. So I think there's a philosophy that the result has to motivate the activity.
Yeah.
Whereas I think the activity can drive the result, and then the result drives the activity.
So are you sort of saying, like, if you're only thinking about the result, you're less likely to get there?
I think because it becomes like a lofty goal, so everyone wants to be thinner or fitter or more intelligent or be a CEO of a big company, for example. Whatever it is, I think if you just have that goal but don't think of it in terms of here's what I need to do to do that, that becomes self-fulfilling. It becomes essentially like this magical goal on cloud nine that's nice to have, but not, there's no plan to it. So, for example, I think if you run, then that running will then inspire you to want to do the marathon, which will then inspire you to run more. Whereas I think the four part that people make is I want to complete the marathon, and then that's where it ends.
I've never really understood people who run marathons.
My mum ran one, and
she
did.
Wow. It's a really long distance.
It's very long distance. I was so impressed with her.
It's nuts. Well done, her.
Yeah. So it was a few years ago now. So, Mum, if you're listening, Will's very proud. So have I. She did amazingly. I think at one point, obviously, she was worried that she wouldn't be able to do it in the 8 hours. So she's very motivated by medals, for example.
Okay.
And she really wanted a kind of a staircase where she could display all her medals, and the grand medal of all medals was the London Marathon, of course.
Okay.
And she initially, we were kind of hatching a plan. If she couldn't complete it in 8 hours, I'd run like the last 5 or 10. Well, it's 10, very ambitious, maybe just about 5 kilometers for it. But no, she did it in 7.5 hours. I was very impressed, because even just walking 42K is a huge ask in 8 hours. So,
yeah.
But you know, again, with her, it was... her motivation drove from the fact that someone told her she couldn't do it, and it was kind of proving them wrong. But the way she started was, again, just run this amount and this amount, and it kind of drove her to do that.
So I mean, back to libraries, which we're struggling with today. We're struggling with staying on topic. I think for me personally, it was not the environment, but it was the routine.
Okay.
It's the routine which gets me to be productive. And so I went to a library maybe twice, three times the whole time I was at university.
Wow.
And otherwise, I just worked in my room at my desk.
Okay.
But if I was just like, I need to do a bit of work today, I wouldn't do it. I would need the routine of getting up for breakfast, then going and do that regularly, and then I could work effectively. I did go to, so I tried working in the library. I think in second year I was like, I'll see what this is all about. But I got there and I realized I'd left one or two of my textbooks that I needed in my room. But this was, I was living in an annex at this point. So it was about a 15, 20 minute walk. So I then walked back and got it and then walked back again. At this point, I wasted about probably an hour, probably more. And I was a bit fed up and I was like, okay, well, let's see if it was worth it.
So you went home.
Well, so I went home pretty shortly afterwards, actually. I think I just, I found, so for me, I found libraries off-putting. There was sort of, obviously there's the pressure to be working and that's really important for some people. But for me, I sort of, I reacted to that differently. And I actually found myself going on like Facebook on my laptop more than I would if I was working in my room.
Interesting.
Really weird. I just had a very adverse reaction to the library and I never really got back into it. But, you know, I think as your three friends earlier demonstrated, they can be a useful tool if they're right for you and you can do very well with it. But I don't, it's not like, it's not necessary to be able to work productively and do well. And
I wonder if there has been a study, actually, it'd be really interesting to see on scholars and the kind of academic profiles of where they study and their work habits. It'd be really interesting to know.
Yeah. I imagine there's probably also, a sort of like a personality type analysis to do alongside that. Because, it works well for some people, not so well for other people, and there's got to be some kind of motivator behind that. But yeah, I think I was wary that lots of people were going to the library and I wasn't. And I was sort of a bit apprehensive about that, which is why I gave it a go.
Right.
But ultimately, I got over it and just used my desk in my room. I think if I hadn't had a desk, I wouldn't have had any choice. I would have had to.
Yeah, so I suppose that's a good point, that I suppose if you don't have the facilities or equipment you need, then, for example, loads of people I knew didn't have printers. I mean, I was lucky that I just had a really compact printer I could use in my first year. But if you need facilities like printing, or if you're in a departmental library and you need access to periodicals or specific textbooks, I suppose everything's much easier nowadays online. But I remember the one of my friends who was doing history just needed access to some very old texts, and he had to go to the university library for that because it's just those weren't digitized. So I guess some of those factors are necessary, but it's not a default place of work for them.
I found myself using books less and less as I went on, because basically all my reading was just research papers, and those are all very easy to access. You know, you had your university login and you'd be able to go on any of the various sort of publishing sites and access it. And so whilst I did buy some books and sort of took out some books from libraries, didn't really use them as much as, you know, someone like that would, where they it does have to be a paper copy or whatever it is.
I guess the other thing, you know, we've kind of touched on this earlier, is the timing restrictions imposed upon you by the library. So my college library, there was a huge kind of uproar when the hourly, I think we extended hours from 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock in exam term.
Okay.
And people were outraged, whereas other people thought that was a very sensible thing to do.
Why were people outraged about that?
Well, I think the flip side of it was they didn't want to encourage people to be working so late into the night. So Keyes's approach to this was, you turn up when the library opens at 7 a.m. and you're welcome to stay till 10. And after that, that's your day done. You shouldn't be working after that.
Yeah.
You could say that probably encourages quite a healthy attitude, but
You
know, some people's body clocks are different. I know certainly I worked much better if I had a clear night in mind. I probably worked a lot better in the evenings once I'm into the flow of things. So you perhaps don't want to be disturbed.
Yeah.
When you're kind of wrapping, you know, when you're so deep into thought.
I think also if you've got a deadline tomorrow, you don't care if it's unhealthy. No, you just want to do it.
But I suppose long term it discourages you from doing that, because you have to clear out all your stuff and take it home.
Yeah.
So I suppose also the other thing was some of us did live quite far away, like quite far for Cambridge terms, like 10 minute cycle away. Mm. So perhaps they didn't want people cycling at 3 or 4 a.m.
Too late. Yeah.
I think principally it was just to encourage a slightly healthy attitude. But I was I was quite astounded by the polarity of differences that made.
So ours was similar, actually. I think it closed at midnight, and just generally there was always upset from the student body about it. Mm. There was most GMs, or like at least once a year, there'd be a, can we extend the hours? Because quite a few colleges did have 24-hour libraries. I mean,
there was one next to ours, which actually had beds in the library.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I thought that was taking things quite extreme.
Yeah. I had never considered, at the time, I'd never thought actually it encourages you not to be working late at night.
Mm.
Obviously, the argument is we want to be able to work when we need to / want to work. Mm. I think they eventually got it extended to be open till 1 a.m.
Okay.
But, I mean, so from college's perspective, they didn't want to have to staff it 24/7. And also, like, you know, I'm sure the librarians were like, maybe we won't be running all the way through the night, which is understandable.
Yeah.
But it was obviously an important topic for a lot of people. It sort of passed me by a little bit because I wasn't too fussed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we used to have all sorts of weird events. There was this one time when Professor Carpenter, who I'm sure you're familiar with, was turned up to Keys Library and started playing his bongos. That was just a very Cambridge moment. It was some kind of coronation or convocation. I don't quite recall, but
people are usually pretty upset about noise in the library. I've been told off quite a few times being too noisy outside.
Yes, it was a very surreal, very Cambridge moment. But so I suppose if we start to kind of bring this to a close, based on what we talked about right at the start of people wanting to simulate a classroom at university, do you think, based on what's been happening in the real world now, and when we go back, libraries will still be as fashionable or as utilised?
I think for university students, yes. Mm. I mean, you see, you know, at the start of lockdown, there was the, oh, we'll never need offices again.
Mm.
We'll have so much extra space now. The whole of inner city London will be, I don't know, a big zoo or whatever. But actually now, the general sentiment is we like offices, you know, maybe we don't need them as much as before, but we like having them around and going to them a little bit.
Yeah, it seems to be a move towards a kind of a hybrid model of half from home. Half
3 days in, two home, that kind of thing. And you know, that's fine. But I think there's still obviously that internal need for most people to be working somewhere and enjoying yourself somewhere else.
Mm.
And at university, that's going to be there. And so if you're enjoying yourself is in your room and, you know, out and about, and then having the library is that where you're working, I think there is still going to be that need. But again, students, school kids don't really have that need.
I mean, back ages ago when I was at school, some of the boarding students used to actually have enforced something called, they used to call it prep time, which is essentially, it was enforced work hours where they would go into essentially wooden cubicles and study for 2 hours.
Okay.
And they essentially weren't allowed to leave that without like the housemistress or housemaster's permission.
Yeah.
So I suppose I was kind of simulating a library-esque environment for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of sneaky of schools, because when you're doing an 8-hour school day and then another 2 hours of enforced prep, and that's not an 8-hour school day, that's a 10-hour school day.
Yeah.
And obviously schools sort of hide behind that, and I think often they don't appreciate that very often students will be working for 10 plus hours a day, certainly for people who don't find things as straightforward. Mm. But schools don't really seem to mind that much about that. Whereas at university, it is kind of, it's up to you. And if you need to do a 12 or 14 hour work day, then you need to do it.
Yeah, and some of the students I've spoken to, one of them's at a really, really prestigious international college, and their day starts at 8, sometimes earlier, and they carry on till about 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah.
And they do that 6 days a week, and on Sundays sometimes they have the day off, other times they'll have a half day as well.
Half day.
So, you know, obviously they do, they get results, but I suppose coming back to the overall topic, it's, I suppose we're saying that the environment can influence things, but only if there's sufficient separation of work and play.
Mm.
How did you go about creating that separation? Because presumably you worked at your laptop,
yeah,
and therefore needed to, you know, relax through your laptop as well.
So I think, I mean, I think for me it was less, I don't know, maybe I didn't feel like I needed that separation as much. But also I wouldn't necessarily spend huge amounts of time in my room, like, again, so the room was sort of where I slept and worked and maybe spent a bit of time, but actually I spent quite a lot of time at hall or, you know, wandering around.
And just have this image of you wandering the halls of Christchurch, admiring the artwork.
Well, I mean, so it's sort of, it depends. I think it does depend on where you spend your time. And I think certainly in first year, where I did spend more time in my room just watching TV or whatever, and I didn't work very effectively. But then in third year, when I was out of my room more, I guess it did become a bit more of a separation. But again, for me, it was the routine that made the biggest difference. You know, I was either in working, revising mode, routine, or not, basically. And I think as long as you have some kind of distinction, however you make that distinction, you need to have it. Otherwise, you're worried that you're always working.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really important point, is that consistency is what delivers results most of the time.
So yeah, yeah.
I can't remember who it is now, but essentially he talks about it's not your top speed that matters, it's really your average speed in anything you do. So it's not how fast you finish the marathon, it's actually your average speed through the marathon. Or in your case, it might just be how it's not how intensely you worked in the last 2 weeks before your exams, it's how much you did throughout. So yeah, consistency is definitely a key thing that people seem to forget, and that I think routine definitely helps with that consistency, because it's very hard to be consistent.
And so, because I knew that I'd want to have lots of breaks, so I knew that I'd have to give myself a bit more run up to do anything effectively in order to do it effectively. So I think it's so important, you know, just being wary of that, being able to notice what works for you and what doesn't, and then being able to make plans accordingly. You know, if you know you work well at home, then you can. But if you know you don't, then you should force yourself into a library. Otherwise, you're just not going to work well.
Yeah.
And then eventually enjoy the library, you know, after a while. I certainly feel like I missed out on a bit of a subculture. but, you know, it's... I think when I was in my room, there was one extra space in the library for someone who needed it.
Yeah. How very altruistic of you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what was going through my mind when I made that decision.
Yeah, so suppose what we're saying is collectively, it's not just the spatial environment, it's also the temporal setting. So it's not just the workspace, but it's also when you choose, and libraries are just a tool to kind of allow you to do that.
And like you were saying earlier, you work quite well in the evening. I actually found when I set up my routine, I was most effective in the morning, and I sort of around 4 or 5 I'd sort of peter off a bit, and being aware of that is so important. And making the most of that, optimizing it, basically.
And you know, it's quite a hard thing to know what time you work best,
but
I actually figured out, because this comes back to my favorite thing about Anki. You know, if Anki are listening, then we're very open to sponsorships.
We'll get it one day.
Yeah, it'll probably be a very long time because Anki's free. So please do download Anki. It'll change your lives. But continuing back on, I actually found out, because Anki, I used to do Anki flashcards for my medical revision throughout the day. And the cool thing about Anki is it actually graphs your performance every hour of every day. So you can actually see not only how many cards you get through in a 20-minute slot, but more importantly, what the percentage of correct answers that you give is. So that's kind of how I figured out. And it ironically tended to be slightly different if it was a weekend or a weekday, which, you know, in the middle of exam term, it shouldn't matter that much, but it still did.
Yeah.
So But again, there's lots of tools now which people should be using to definitely make full use of them.
I think it's so easy to get into bad habits.
Yeah.
But
and I suppose that can become a routine as well. The bad habit can become a routine, which is even more dangerous.
Yeah. I think at one point I did find myself like procrastinating in the same ways each time, and I was like, well, how am I going to kick this, because this is terrible.
And I had one friend at the library, he used to stay there far longer than most people and be almost the first person there and leave generally almost later than me. Every time I went over to his desk, he would either be on Facebook or looking up some upgrades for his phone or shopping or something. So, you know, he clearly wasn't effective.
Yeah,
it was just he'd solidified and essentially made these bad behaviors into his routine, and then it was very hard to break that cycle.
I think people can confuse being at the library with working effectively. And you know, as soon as you realize that they're not one and the same, or you know, usually they are, but if you notice it's not, then you need to make a change.
So the other interesting thing is, in the last 2 weeks before any exams, in the run-up, I used to actually move out of the library.
Okay.
So similar to what you said, is you should try and peak at the 2 weeks. That was my philosophy as well. Is I feel like I should know pretty much everything I need to by the end of 2 weeks, 2 weeks before my exams. And then I just used to take it relatively easy and speak to people a lot more, kind of social. I probably pestered them more than they wanted me to.
Yeah, they're probably really busy.
But actually, I found that socialization aspect really useful.
Okay.
And something you can't do at the library is hold like group revision sessions together and kind of just bounce ideas off each other, which you think in medicine would be quite difficult because there's only so many ways you can write the kidney filters of blood, but you'd be surprised because we had to be very creative for our essays. So that kind of thing was really, really, really interesting.
I think one thing as well which is good about Oxford and Cambridge, and one thing that I probably didn't make the most of, is when you're at hall, that doesn't just have to be a time to just chat about random stuff. That can be a time to talk about academic stuff. And obviously, you know, at high table, they're probably being all, you know, talking about their, you know, whatever they're up to. But very often it would be an opportunity to sort of switch off completely and just talk about something completely else. But actually, you're there with relatively intelligent people. You can make the most of them being there and bounce ideas off them and see what they think. And it doesn't just have to be someone who's doing your subject. Sometimes a fresh perspective can ask questions which you sort of gloss over or wouldn't think to. And then you realize, oh, actually, yeah, that's a good point. So, you know, that is, you could see why they have it, having hall. I remember speaking with one of the professors at, I can't remember which college, might have been UNIV, and they were saying that they're worried because the JCR is really, really wants to get rid of formal and have it, you know, or whatever it was. If they had formals three times a week, they wanted to get just down to one so that they could just get the kind of get your food, go. And they were really worried because they were like, well, you know, we want them to be sitting with each other. We want them to be chatting.
Yeah, I think, you know, that generally advancements and scientific breakthroughs then tend to come from super special, well, either they come from super specialized, super, super specialized experts. Well, the second thing, particularly in business, tends to be kind of this, someone who's done an engineering degree then goes on to do a, I don't know, like a history degree or something, or someone, or maybe an engineering degree followed by something in evolutionary biology. And it tends to be that cross-pollination of disciplines that tends to produce these kind of breakthroughs, because otherwise you kind of get entrenched in your way of thinking.
When I was at the perception lab, basically none of them had studied psychology as an undergraduate. They'd all moved over from like physics or something like that.
But I suppose that's probably time for another discussion.
Potentially.
So I suppose we should start wrapping up. My kind of conclusion to this is actually the library's only one core piece of how to work optimally, and there's other things to it.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Okay.
That works for me.
So
yeah.
have you got an interesting fact for us?
I do, yeah. So this is something that I saw the other day and made sense to share it because I knew this was coming. But 87% of Ian Fleming's Bond novels talk about scrambled eggs.
Oh.
Which is a weird thing to talk about so frequently in a spy book. But obviously, you know, Ian had some preferences about breakfast.
Is that Bond cooking the scrambled egg? Or, for, you know, the night after?
So I haven't experienced each scrambled eggs mentioned personally.
Okay.
But as I understand it,
that'd be a great podcast, I think.
It would be good, and I think there's plenty of room for that. But from what I have experienced of the James Bond character, I don't think he spends much time cooking.
Is that on the literary view or the film?
Well, I've read about 0.5 Bond books.
Okay.
And I've watched a few films, and in none of those experiences was he cooking. I actually didn't, well, it's a while ago since I read it, but I don't remember scrambled eggs being mentioned. Maybe that was one of the 13%.
Yeah. It was either half.
Also potential. Yeah. So that's what I've got.
Okay. So I've got I knew we would be talking about Oxford and Cambridge quite a lot and working patterns. So I've actually got an interesting one about Isaac Newton, which I remembered. And so everyone's quite familiar with the story about the apple and Isaac Newton and the fact that he was at Trinity College and you can still see the apple tree or a version of that tree. It's not the same one, of course. But what I thought was quite interesting was, and this is particularly appropriate because when Newton was around, it was obviously the time of the Black Death.
Mm-hmm.
And then out comes Newton with his theory, his wonderful theories of gravity and various other things.
Yeah.
But during the Black Death, he actually went to his professor and said, to the scientific community and said, I think the planets, when they rotate the sun, people think that it's a circular orbit, but actually it's an elliptical orbit.
Okay.
And no one believed him. They said, well, there's no way,
But what was his reasoning?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. So he just said, no, I just know this is true. I just know intuitively this is true. And people said, there's no way, because gravity is an inverse square law, so the further away you get, the weaker gravity gets, and there's no way that would work in an elliptical orbit. It has to be circular, or essentially it's a sphere, and you just take one plane of a sphere, and that obviously makes sense.
Mm.
And Newton said, no, absolutely not. It's definitely an ellipsis. And the scientific community essentially said, prove it.
Mm.
So he spent the next, I think, 6 to 18 months, I can't remember exactly how much, after he figured out how to discover true zero. He came up with a new branch of mathematics because he was trying to solve equations and he just couldn't solve them because the maths to do that didn't exist.
Okay.
So he spent this huge amount of time essentially creating a new branch of mathematics.
Wow.
And you're probably quite familiar with it, Will. You may have studied it in your school days, but it's actually, he invented calculus.
Okay.
And then proved that the orbit was elliptical indeed.
Imagine inventing calculus as like a side hustle for what you're really trying to do.
Now, I'm probably giving him a little bit too much credit here. Apparently, there is this, you may have heard of the Newton-Raphson-Lorentz method, which is, so Newton was apparently one of...
It rings a bell.
So obviously, there's lots of ways you can solve for a turning point, solve a differential.
Okay.
And Newton's method was one of them. But there was also a chap called Raphson. As you can imagine, Newton was just so far ahead of him in everything that he kind of just fell in the history books. But and actually, they think that the Arabs actually discovered calculus well before Newton did.
Okay.
But then it was lost to the kind of dark ages when at least went through them.
Okay.
But it still shouldn't take away from Newton's achievements.
Yeah, that's pretty nuts.
But yeah, just to be able to have such confidence in yourself to be able to create a new branch of mathematics.
And we have that he didn't record anywhere pre doing the calculus and all that why he felt that way.
Well, not that I know of.
Okay.
So yeah, it's quite an impressive story.
Because it's theoretically, if a million people make a wild claim of some kind, some of them are going to be right.
Yeah.
And I guess that's kind of where those people that predict events in the future, they're like, oh, they were so close. But if you say enough vague stuff, you will eventually be right. But it's pretty specific to say that, and not only say it then and go and prove it as well.
Yeah,
not bad.
I suppose we don't know what other 500 things he predicted.
He could have said loads of nonsense. Yeah,
yeah, but he seemed to know what he was talking about. I mean, I disagree with his notion that the rainbow is made up of seven colours. I think they were just obsessed with the number seven back then because it was all magical.
Okay.
So I personally disagree with the seven colours. I mean, violet and indigo and blue, come on, they're the same colour.
Yeah.
So, but, apart from that, Lord Newton knew what he was doing, so let's respect him.
Yeah. Well done.
He used to say, I have achieved only what I have because I've stood on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
But I think he was probably just a giant
himself. Yeah, he did a good job. Yeah. Yeah, lots of important working out, lots of important science.
So on that interesting bombshell, we should call it a day.
Yeah, okay, but awesome.
Good catching up with you, Will.
Yeah, good to speak briefly about libraries yeah. and mostly about other stuff.
But all vaguely relevant, I hope.
Vaguely, I think just we tied it in enough. It was tenuous, but we made it.
Yeah, all right.
Awesome.